pushy with that. So basically, many war crimes have been committed. Like, there's been, first of all, civilians have been shot to death at gunpoint in different territories occupied by the Ukrainian forces, by the Ukrainian army.
Mm-hmm.
And citizens have also been kidnapped at checkpoints run by the Ukrainian army and then tortured severely. And then they were very severely borrowing both techniques used by the CIA in Guantanamo and techniques used by the Bandera fascist gangs in during World War II. And then they're usually exchanged with for Ukrainian soldiers who were captured by the Donetsk People's Republic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably, like, no one knows for certain, but there are hundreds of people who are currently in Ukrainian prisons being tortured, and no one knows their whereabouts. No one knows what is the latest or how they are.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, like, journalists have been killed, like, communist leaders have been killed, the Communist Party is outlawed in Ukraine.
I believe your trade unions also have been repressed, right?
Yes. And they're doing that because they embarked on a very strong austerity program.
A privatization, like, across the board, right?
Exactly. And that's why the economic situation there is just going to deteriorate.
Mm.
Because that's been also the precondition for the loans that they've been receiving for the IMF, is that they've taken very strong austerity programs. And the quality of life is expected to deteriorate very rapidly, and it already is. And that's why, of course, we'll be seeing, like, probably more and more militaristic actions taken. And also that's why the government has been engaged in, like, ultra-nationalist propaganda.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, it's not just Ukraine. Ukraine is maybe the most extreme example of this, but even if you look at Poland, if you look at other countries in Eastern Europe that are really kind of, you know, engaged in mass privatization and all this sort of stuff, they use the most vitriolic nationalist rhetoric imaginable, right? And try to direct all the people's attention against various minority groups, you know, say that they're the problem, they need to be destroyed, they need to be repressed, you know, like, you know, Poland for the Poles, Ukrainian for Ukrainians, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, really it's just a cover for privatization. You know, fascism is a cover for privatization.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Like, you make an excellent point, and I'll just make 2 points I have on this issue, because I think that's an excellent, very important point. The first is that, like, I think Ukraine is a classical case to anyone who studies it, like, in depth, for the fact that fascism and capitalism goes very well together.
Yep.
And in fact, actually a Greek filmmaker just produced a film called Fascism INC, in which he covers that relationship between fascism and capitalism. And he obviously claims that fascism is an advanced stage of capitalism. But that Ukraine is a perfect very good example for a situation in which the government embarks on war and fascism because it's an economic crisis.
Yep.
And in a way, if you look at the broad picture in Europe, there's two countries where capitalism failed very clearly. The one first one is Ukraine. The other one is Greece.
Yeah.
So while in Ukraine, the government has been pursuing war and fascism in order to have people deflect their attention from the economic crisis. In Greece, the government has been trying to negotiate it, but they're under incredible pressure, and it's unclear at this point whether they will surrender or not to the dictates of the European Union, to the neoliberal dictates.
Yeah.
But these are two places where capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, failed very clearly. Obviously, Spain too, but in Greece it's even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But very few make the connection between, like, the fact that this is a crisis of capitalism and that and the connection between these two regions, and also the connection between fascism and militarism and capitalism. Because if you look, the first time that actually even the word privatization, as it was in German, came from during the Nazi regime. That's when, like, the government carried out, like, privatization.
Yeah, it's true.
And very few people are aware of that, actually. So it's the thing is, it becomes very clear in the case of Ukraine and also in the case of Nazi Germany that you can have many, you can practice a very different, like, take capitalism to a very extreme stage when you have fascism on your side. And that's actually also the concern, like, globally, that we're moving more and more to a situation, because capitalism seems to be in a structural crisis, mm-hmm. coming to its end, like in the coming decades, as like Emmanuel Wallerstein, for example, argues, that basically there's we're in a situation in which we'll be moving either to feudalism and fascism, and we see it more and more in like the repression of civil liberties and the cracking and the police repression by the police in different Western countries, or to like a more socialist, a more humane alternative.
Even more revolutionary situation, at least in some places, you know. So exactly. It's like this is like the alternative basically would be is between socialism and barbarism, you know.
Exactly.
It's almost becoming that. I think it was Rosa Luxemburg who said that originally. But yeah, like it's pretty. This is like the reason why I don't think people should ignore what's going on in Ukraine, right? Because I mean, this is like this situation is like emerging in many places now. Like just around the world, and you have to understand it. Like if you actually want to, if you want to effectively, like fight for like that better future that we've been, you know, like that socialism, right? Like you really have to understand this stuff.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I think if you look at the global events and understand them more thoroughly, you analyze them more thoroughly, because the mainstream media has been wholly misrepresenting entire regions. It becomes very clear, and I actually spoke to a Greek volunteer who went to visit the region of the Donbass just a few weeks ago, and he told me, look, we're trying to basically, he came to visit, but he's been very active politically in Greece, raising awareness on the issue, and what he's saying is that we're trying to defeat like fascism and NATO in Ukraine, so that they, because if they succeed in Ukraine, they'll do it in other places too. And I think we'll see more and more. My concern is that we're going to see more and more like fascist. We'll be seeing more and more fascist parties rise in different countries as the economy declines, or people choosing socialism in different countries.
Yeah, because obviously you're going to get resistance to fascism as well, right? And that's what also needs to be mentioned. You know, it's not like this kind of stuff happens without a fight. You know,
very true.
Yeah,
very true.
And I guess Donetsk is proof of that.
Very true, as well as many Ukrainians in Kiev and other places who have been protesting against protesting against the U.S. involvement. And those who spoke out against the war crimes have been arrested or killed, but many of them. But definitely people have been resisting. But I think in light of history, when we have a government which praises fascist groups and practices outright fascism, and there are many indications for that, if you look at all the characters
of fascism. Mm-hmm.
Then that people like today are oblivious to that is very disturbing, because fascism doesn't stop at a given point. It obviously seeks to expand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe the right sector now has a presence in Toronto, actually, amongst the Ukrainian community.
That's horrible.
Which is quite a disturbing thing. Golden Dawn does as well. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was, unfortunately, Joshua Tartakovsky. We were interviewing there about the situation in Ukraine. Fortunately, he got cut off, so we weren't able to quite finish the interview. But nonetheless, I do appreciate him coming on back in the USSR. I'm going to try to have him back on at some point in the future. And we more or less, that was actually quite lucky. His phone ran out of credit just as the interview was about to end. So I think that was about the best timing we could have hoped for when it comes to something like that happening. So overall, I'm happy with it. So thank you for listening to Back in the USSR, and please stay tuned. You're listening to Back in the USSR. That was the interview I did in June 2015 with Joshua Tartakovsky, and like he talked about, he had been in the Donetsk People's Republic. He'd been in eastern Ukraine, those areas in eastern Ukraine that had been resisting takeover by the far-right fascist government that basically is in Ukraine right now. Or fascist sympathetic government anyway, and talking once again about how capitalism and fascism go are hand in glove. They're inseparable in Ukraine right now. This is where, you know, situation where everything is getting privatized, trade unions are being cracked down on, workers' demonstrations are being crushed, you know, like benefits are being slashed, old age pensions are being torn up. You know, the IMF is all over it. There's like state enterprises are getting sold off at bargain prices to international investors, this kind of thing. That's what's going on in Ukraine right now. It was going on in 2015. It's gone even further over the last several years.
So that's really what the people who are fighting against fascism in Ukraine are up against. And I think he does a pretty good job in describing just what a battleground Ukraine is right now, where people are actually going up against extreme odds, resisting fascism in the far right, and the just capitalism effectively gone berserk. Now, I finally want to come back to Canada's support for fascism in Ukraine, because it's very real, and the government has repeatedly, the government of Justin Trudeau has repeatedly dismissed as Russian propaganda practically every criticism of this policy. And, you know, as I said earlier, in earlier episodes of the show, Canada is an integral part of the Western alliance that is propping up the far-right regime that came in after the 2014 U.S.-backed coup. And Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland has been among the most active Western politicians supporting intervention in Ukraine. And as I've talked about in previous shows, has actively misrepresented her own family history and her grandfather's role as a Nazi propagandist in the 1940s. But she's far from alone. Not only does the Liberal Party and the sitting government support this policy, but there is essentially complete bipartisan support. And not just from the Conservative Party either. Eve Engler has recently pointed out in on the website Dissident Voice, just yesterday, in fact, how the NDP has supported intervention in Ukraine and has been cozy with the cause of the Ukrainian far right and the Ukrainian Canadian far right, with people like Olivia Chow speaking at, you know, right-wing Ukrainian rallies in Toronto, supporting the Euromaidan protests, supporting the 2014 coup, you know, supporting Canadian intervention in Ukraine. And it's absolutely disgusting seeing this cross-the-board support for neo-Nazis in mainstream Canadian politics, but that's the reality right now. You know, the American Empire has an agenda to use Ukraine as a strategic weapon against Russia. And these far-right Ukrainian forces, such as Azov Battalion and the Right Sector, they're really coming to the fore, just as they did during the Cold War, because they're seen as useful by the powers that be. They're seen as useful by imperialism. And here's another report on The Real News from Max Blumenthal, which actually talks about how open Ukrainian Nazis have recently been welcomed on Capitol Hill. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Ben Norton. In recent weeks in Ukraine, which is a close NATO ally, neo-Nazi vigilante groups have carried out attacks on ethnic and religious minority groups, including Roma, Jews, and also sexual minorities, including the LGBT community. At the same time, while this is happening, the U.S. is actually welcoming fascist leaders from the Ukrainian government here in Washington, D.C. The head of the Ukrainian parliament, known as the Rada, is himself a neo-Nazi who founded two neo-Nazi parties. He's named Andriy Parubiy, and he was invited to speak at an event at the Senate, which was hosted by the American Foreign Policy Society. Parubiy previously founded two neo-Nazi organizations, the Social National Party and also the Patriot of Ukraine, which are linked to violence against ethnic minority groups like the Roma, who have recently been attacked and their villages have been burnt down by neo-Nazi vigilantes in Ukraine. I'm joined today by the journalist Max Blumenthal, who attended this event at the Senate, and asks why a Nazi was invited to speak in the U.S. Senate.
Given that there is open anti-Semitism on display in Ukraine and anti-Roma violence, do you think it was a good idea to invite the founder of two neo-Nazi parties, the Social National Party and the Patriot of Ukraine? I'm referring to Mr. Parubiy.
Max wrote about this event for the Gray Zone Project, which is a website he edits, and his article is titled, "Congress Welcomes an Actual Fascist as Nazi Violence Rages in Ukraine." Max has also previously reported here at the Real News Network on how the U.S. is arming the Azov Battalion, which is a neo-Nazi militia that's part of the Ukrainian National Guard. Max is an award-winning journalist who edits the website The Gray Zone Project, which you can find at thegrayzoneproject.com. He also co-hosts a podcast with me. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me on.
So can you explain what happened at this Senate event?
Yeah, I think you explained it pretty well. A open neo-fascist who founded two parties that could pretty much be succinctly described as neo-Nazi was welcomed onto Capitol Hill. He had just met with Representative Paul Ryan, who is actually his counterpart as the Republican Speaker of the House. And he also met with the State Department officials, who were really so proud of their meeting with Parubi that they tweeted about the good meeting they had. And you actually wrote a great piece for us at the Gray Zone on Parubi's meetings last year with John McCain and also Paul Ryan. So this wasn't the first time that, you know, Congress had rolled out the red carpet for Parubi. The two parties he founded, the Social National Party, which sounds a lot like the National Socialist Party or the Nazi Party because it was inspired by it. Its symbol is the wolf's angle, which is now the symbol of the Azov Battalion. And the Patriot of Ukraine, the racist violent militia that Parubi helped found in the 90s, are now sort of at the heart of the extremist violence that is plaguing this country and has exploded into the open since Ukraine was destabilized by a U.S.-backed coup attempt in 2014. And Parubi was in Washington alongside three other speakers of parliament who were kind of making the rounds to kind of lobby for more aid because their countries are sustained by aid on the condition that they act as de facto NATO bases. And to pledge to help the U.S. stop the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. This is a gas pipeline that will run from Russia to Germany and really represents a key threat in the minds of the bipartisan foreign policy establishment in Washington to American economic control over Western Europe. And so they're doing everything they can to stop it. And they clearly don't care. Parubi's hosts at the American Foreign Policy Society, which is not a right-wing group, and his hosts in Congress, and many of the people who were at this meeting, who are Hill staffers from both sides of the aisle, did not care about his fascist background or about the hideous acts of violence. And we're talking about lethal pogroms against Roma people that are consuming Ukraine. And so, you know, it was pretty embarrassing when I showed up and asked this basic question, and I did not get a clear answer from the host of this event.
Yeah, and can you talk a bit more about Andriy Parubi, who's the head of the Ukrainian parliament, and he wrote a book a few decades ago, in which he can be seen on the cover wearing a brown shirt style uniform. And then also, can you talk a bit about the situation? You mentioned the Azov Battalion. You've reported here at the Real News Network on how the U.S. has armed this militia. And of course, the reasoning that the U.S. has is that this is part of the Ukrainian government and they're fighting Russia, which they say is the aggressor. Can you explain more about the situation?
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is sort of on a key piece on the strategic chessboard for the West. And, you know, Ukrainians have been kind of used as pawns for decades, since World War II, when it was torn between German Nazi occupation and the Soviet Union. And so you have Ukrainians in the East who identify with Russia, speak Russian, and want nothing to do with Kiev. And in Kiev, there are these nationalist elements which are taking control of what was supposed to be sort of a technocratic government set up by the U.S., just kind of like this imperial vassal government, which is completely mired in corruption right now. And the warnings that there would be sort of a fascist putsch were very clear in 2014. Nationalism had exploded into the open. One of the key symbols of the forces in the Maidan was Stepan Bandera, who is a Nazi collaborator who founded the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. He was involved along with Roman Shukhevich, who is a hero in contemporary Ukrainian society, in the massacre, the pogroms against the Jewish community of Lviv in 1941. And Parubi has been really at the heart of trying to resurrect Banderism, this sort of nostalgia for Nazi-occupied Ukraine, which is, you know, anti-Russian, vigorously anti-Russian, so it supports American strategic interests at this point. You mentioned Parubi's book, View from the Right. He wrote this book, I think, in 1998 or 9, and it show you can see him on the cover of the book in a literal brown shirt, like in a Nazi SA uniform with a pistol on his waist in a holster. And in the book, he blames, you know, the long-haired hippies and various immigrant Untermenschen for, he didn't use the term Untermenschen, but he blames them for destroying Western civilization. The party he co-founded, the Social National Party in 1995, pledged to, save the white race again and preserve the white race against the degradation of humanity. I mean, this is an explicitly white nationalist party. In the early 2000s, Parubi was the chairman of the committee to build a monument to Stepan Bandera in the city of Lviv, where the Jewish population was wiped out by his forces. And since 2014, the forces that Parubi oversaw in the Maidan, the right sector forces, who are these black-masked ultra-nationalists, many of whom were avowed neo-Nazis, have been militarized and incorporated into the National Guard under the watch of the Interior Minister, who is in Parubi's current party, the People's Front Party. And the Interior Minister's name is Arsen Avakov. But the militarized version of the parties that he helped found is called the Azov Battalion. And they are kind of like the shock troops of the Ukrainian military in the east around the Donbass region in the fight against pro-Russian separatists. As I reported earlier this year, they've been armed by the U.S. And they have an ideology which is explicitly white nationalist, along with a membership corps that consists substantially of avowed neo-Nazis who wear the same Nazi symbols that we saw on the streets of Charlottesville when white nationalists marched through there. Their ideology centers around the concept of the Reconquista, the reconquest of Europe on behalf of the white races led by the traditional white nations, with Ukraine at the center. The chief ideologue now is named Andrei Beletsky, and he hates the current government in Kiev, led by Petro Poroshenko, this corrupt technocrat. And he is sought to start the reconquest by leading the Azov Battalion's forces from eastern Ukraine into Kiev. That actually happened this year with this terrifying show of force by a so-called national corps or national militia of Azov members, hardcore jackbooted thugs, who deployed to Kiev to supposedly restore order. And this has complemented a wave of violence across the country by other neo-Nazi forces against Roma, against LGBT people, against left-wing dissidents, communists, and Jews. Amnesty International issued a report this year warning that no one is safe in Ukraine as long as these extremist forces are on the march. And one of the bands of Nazi thugs who are killing and attacking Roma people at their encampments is called C-14. The 14 is for the 14 words, which is the mantra of international neo-Nazism. And they are state-funded. And it's not us reporting that. It was Radio Free Europe, which, you know, the U.S., the arm of the U.S. government's media operation, which reported that the C-14 neo-Nazi militias killing Roma in Ukraine are funded by the state, which means that our aid money is going to neo-Nazis while Parubi is being hosted in Washington. It seems to me like an international scandal that should shock everyone. But unfortunately, I was alone in this issuing this one critical question upon Parubi's visit.
Yeah, and Max, in the video you published at the Gray Zone Project, you also can be seen questioning Michael Carpenter, who is a former Obama administration official who was the director for Russia on the National Security Council. And Michael Carpenter, in response to you, he implied that this is all just Russian propaganda. Here, we'll play a clip.
Following the Senate event, I spotted Michael Carpenter, a former State Department official who helped encourage the 2014 Maidan coup in Ukraine, alongside his boss, then Vice President Joe Biden.
Did you think it was a good idea to bring Perubi, who's founded two neo-Nazi parties, to the Senate, and for Paul Ryan to meet with him?
Look, I think Andrei Perubi is a conservative nationalist who is also a patriot, cares about his country. I don't think he has any neo-Nazi inclinations nor background. I mean, a lot has been made of this. Frankly, I think it's mostly Russian propaganda.
So, Max, can you briefly respond to this allegation that this is all just Russian propaganda?
Well, it was a remarkable defense of Perubi by Carpenter, someone who played a really influential role in the Obama administration, in the Defense Department and State Department, in overseeing U.S. policy towards Ukraine and Russia. And he's now, you know, out there as a kind of ferociously anti-Russian pundit, dismissing, you know, he's working at the NATO think tank in Washington, the Atlantic Council, dismissing all of this as Russian propaganda. Well, Eugene Robinson, who isn't exactly, you know, a Kremlin propagandist, he writes a column for the Washington Post, and he's mostly usually writes fairly, you know, milquetoast liberal opinions, called Perubi's party openly neo-fascist. We also know, that Congress has enacted a ban on weapons to the Azov Battalion through Representative Ro Khanna, who's a Democrat in the House. Is Congress controlled by the Kremlin? Or maybe perhaps Congress was troubled by some of what it learned about the Azov Battalion, which grew out of the party that Perubi founded. I really see no sign that Perubi has reformed his ultra-nationalism, his fascism. And it's really incumbent on people like Carpenter and on Congress to start condemning the violence against minority communities in Ukraine that's taking place under its watch.
Well, we'll have to end our conversation there. We were joined by Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning journalist. He's also the founder and editor of the Gray Zone Project, which you can find at grayzoneproject.com. I contribute to that website, and I also co-host a podcast with Max, Moderate Rebels. You can find his reporting at grayzoneproject.com, and we were discussing a video that he published, which you can also find on YouTube. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks for having me.
For The Real News, I'm Ben Norton.
We'd say that the ideas that they put forward outside football grounds on working class estates have to be combated politically, but also that they've got a physical agenda and that has to be met physically as well. People have to defend themselves against the fascists. They can't just turn the other cheek.
Back, body burns out in an hospital. Children on hospital, gone in advance. Survived for a man.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
EdVideo is Guelph's hub for creation of video art, film, and documentaries. Get started in production or advance your existing skills. Find creative challenges and develop a network of collaborators through our year-round series of workshops and educational programs. We offer hands-on training with video production technology, as well as opportunities to learn from staff and industry professionals. Apply your skills with access to professional quality equipment in an inclusive, fun environment. Learn, create, and display your work through EdVideo. Become a member by visiting our partially accessible location at 404 York Road or visit edvideo.org.
Blues Around the Block. Everything from folk to rock and electric, and all stops in between, occasionally veering off the tracks into the unknown. But trust me, it's all blues all the time. If you love the blues, we've got them here in a whole lot more. Every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. here on 93.3 on your FM dial. CFRU, Campus Community Radio, out of the University of Guelph.
The community food markets are a sliding scale, affordable produce market. Sliding scale means every item is listed with two prices, one just above wholesale cost and one set to average retail cost. You choose where on that spectrum you'd like to pay. The markets are designed to make healthy food cheaper if you're on a tight budget, and if you're not on a tight budget, it offers a way to contribute to your community. Those paying the wholesale cost can save 30 to 50% on the cost of food. We sell over 45 different types of fresh fruits and vegetables. We support local and organic as much as possible. We now have two locations, one downtown at the Guelph Community Health Center at 176 Wyndham Street North on Tuesdays from 3 to 7 p.m., and our newest location is at the Grange Hill East Neighborhood Group on Wednesdays from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. at 525 Grange Road in the community room. Both locations are physically accessible and absolutely everyone is welcome.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lies of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, saving a soul, man. the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and they palm me, they're seeking to draw me away from the brownness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Please they arrest me, materialist tests me, pollution it chokes me, movies they joke me, politicians exploit me, city life jades me. Hudson, they fleece me, hunting laws throw me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. That was Willie Dunn, the song he did in the 1972 National Film Board of Canada production, The Other Side of the Ledger. And of course, he's an Indigenous singer-songwriter. And of course, I think that song, you know, even though it's not about like we're talking about like Ukraine and that sort of thing, but it definitely talks about, of course, settler colonialism in Canada and the terrorism involved in that. And, you know, just illustrates basically we do have that choice in the future effectively between socialism and barbarism, you know, whether we're talking about the barbarism of settler colonialism, the barbarism of fascism, you know, the barbarism of capitalism gone berserk around the world, devastating ecosystems, devastating people's way of life, all this kind of stuff. And of course, all those threats are hand in glove. All those threats to human life are hand in glove. You know, they're going, I mean, you know, Canada, the settler colonial Canada and settler colonial United States and settler colonial Israel are all backing fascism in Ukraine. All of them. You know, and this is the kind of situation that we're in now. Of course, I played Oi Polloi, Bash the Fash, a British anti-fascist song before the break there. And I played Max Blumenthal, his discussion on the Real News of like Ukrainian fascist leaders openly going to Capitol Hill in the U.S. and like speaking before Congress and getting like lauded and by members of the Senate and all this sort of stuff. Like, I mean, complete bipartisan support for that, you know. And I talked about before about how, you know, in Canada, there's like bipartisan support, like even the NDP, you know, is backing this Canadian foreign policy in Ukraine, like this kind of thing. And you know, MLAs in you know, NDP MLAs in Alberta trying to get a certain brand of like Russian vodka banned because it had a hammer and a sickle on it, and like they're just claiming that's like hate speech and stuff, and they want to get that off the shelves. You know, it's just, yeah. And of course those people too, they're complete backers of the Ukrainian nationalists, the far right, people who have a strong presence in this country as well as in Ukraine, and are like basically pushing this whole agenda, you know, completely behind this whole agenda, I should say, like, you know, the behind the American Empire's agenda, I should say, for that part of the world. You know, just like we were in the Cold War, I mean, these were the people who were like, you know, there were Ukrainian fascists at that time who were openly calling on the U.S. to nuke the Soviet Union, like to launch preemptive strikes on them in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was like pushing his Star Wars programs and like being really aggressive and pushing like the world to the brink of nuclear war. The Ukrainian fascists were all about it, you know? And it's just like this is the kind of threat we're facing. And like, I mean, that's not even to getting into the kind of fascism that we see in Canada and the United States. Like we see, you know, when I talked to Clara Sorrenti, you know, in the communist candidate in London, who I interviewed a few weeks ago here on Back in the USSR. I mean, I talked to her about like the strong far-right presence that exists in London that her and her comrades are up against, that they're facing. And it's, you know, and how London used to be a stronghold for the KKK. You know, and it was where the Canadian Nazi Party was founded. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, this exists in Canada as well. I mean, we're up against these kind of fascist far-right forces here as well. And like I said in previous shows, I mean, the election of people like Doug Ford is going to embolden these guys, just like the election of Donald Trump did in the U.S. I mean, you know, not Joshua Tartakovsky, but Max Blumenthal mentioned how, you know, was comparing like some of the tattoos that the Azov Battalion, the neo-Nazis in the Azov Battalion, the right sector, these militias in Ukraine, they had the same kind of tattoos that fascists were wearing during the Charlottesville fascist demonstrations, which, you know, took place in August of last year, you know, in 2017. You know, like it's the same ideology effectively that's on parade and that's out there and that's the, you know, threatening leftists, threatening, you know, LGBTQ people, threatening like racialized people, this sort of stuff, and like threatening them with destruction. You know, fascism is on the move, and of course, like they're targeting all these people. You know, they're in the crosshairs. So what I want to close out the show with actually is actually a report from, you know, a talk which was given by the Workers' World Party, which is the one of the main communist parties in the U.S. that was involved in the counter demonstration against the fascists in Charlottesville, Virginia, last year, along with many other organizations that showed up and really engaged in really heroic resistance that day against fascism. Against what was the biggest fascist demonstration in decades, in the Western Hemisphere, for that matter. There was a lot of heroic resistance to that. And this is what the Workers' World Party had to say about that. This is what they were, this is from this talk, which they gave last year, from people who were actually on the ground in Charlottesville fighting against fascism there last August. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to play that now.
We've all been seeing and participating in anti-fascist actions ever since the Nazis, the KKK, and other white supremacists submerged themselves within the Trump campaign back in 2016 in an attempt to catapult their ideology out of the shadows and into the mainstream. But the degree of organization and coordination of the right and the murder of Heather Heyer and wounding of dozens who bravely stood up to one of the largest rallies of these fascists in decades marks a significant turning point in the struggle against fascism. White supremacist terrorism is nothing new, not in the history of the US, which is founded on white supremacist terrorism, nor in all the years since, where the country thrives and is rescued by alternating waves of white supremacist terror aimed at parts of our population at home, and the terror of the state founded on white supremacy aimed at nations who simply want to determine their own existence abroad. This new wave of Nazi and Klan organizing and the so-called alt-right came into fruition during Obama and grew tremendously through those years by fomenting racist conspiracy theories, engaging in mock lynchings of the president, among other racist speech and mobilization within the ranks of the Koch-funded Tea Party. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors hate organizations in the US, found that there was a tenfold increase in membership in these white supremacist groups and a tenfold increase in the variety of them during the Obama administration. And this map here shows, this is from 2016, the 917 hate organizations in the US. We, of course, have some disagreement with the Southern Poverty Law Center. We don't think that black nationalist organizations are hate groups, which are included in some of this, but the overwhelming majority, of course, about 750 or more are the actual white supremacist terrorists that we're talking about of different varieties. And in the first month from his election, there was 1,100 hate crimes committed. California was at the top with about 130 hate crimes in that first month. So we can see what the election of Donald Trump has done and how the organic connection between these fascists and Trump's rhetoric and agenda has created this situation. And to be clear, the so-called alt-right are really just Nazis and Klansmen without the spine to admit who they really are. They hide behind this benign-sounding label so that they can smile and shake hands with the ordinary worker or middle-class white person in order to recruit them to their no less insane arguments about creating an ethno-state where whites reign as dictators of society. Or worse, adding spinelessness to their spinelessness, making outrageous claims about a so-called white genocide, while everyone else with half a brain or any heart has been forced to watch the wanton murder of black youth in daily videos in every corner of the country with disgust and disdain for this rotten system. These are the types of people who have been engaging in unspeakable and disgusting racist acts of murder, including the murders of Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, Renisha McBride, Dia Yasur and Razan of Chapel Hill, and the elders and women of the Charleston Massacre, Cynthia Graham Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lee Lance, DePayne Middleton, Clementa Pinckney, Tywanza Sanders, Daniel Simmons, Sharonda Coleman Singleton, and Myra Thompson. Or the most recent, the anti-racist heroes in Portland, Ricky John Best and Tylesin Namke Meche, who were killed defending two Muslim women under attack from a white supremacist. There are countless other victims of all walks of life in the last few years of these individual acts of terror by white supremacists and fascists. But what changed in the wake of the Trump campaign was a move toward more overt, organized, and united attempts to build a fascist movement that would adopt open white supremacist rhetoric, or at the very least, hardly veiled dog whistles, what my comrade Eugene actually calls a dog bullhorn now, to create more than a climate of white supremacist terror, but a fact of white supremacist power on the streets to carry out their violence. The stabbings in Anaheim, the shooting of Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis, the immense brawl in Sacramento led by Nazi skinheads, the Klan rallies throughout the South, culminated in the action that took place on Saturday in Charlottesville, where a new degree of unity between fascist organizations and coordinated violence was seen. We are still learning about everything that took place in Charlottesville, and we will continue to learn more as more videos and eyewitness accounts come out. But here are just a few of the main takeaways factually that I've been able to gather for tonight's meeting. The fascists gloated about a so-called surprise event taking place on Friday night, and Spencer alerted the local media to go to the University of Virginia around 9 p.m. This is Richard Spencer, the notorious fascist who was thankfully punched at one point. Some anti-fascists got wind of the planned torchlit march, much like the one that Spencer led in Charlottesville some months ago, through the campus. Spencer and the other neo-Nazi groups marched on the school's central square, chanting "Blood and Soil." This is an old Nazi slogan that referred to the blood of the master race and the soil which only belonged to them. "And you, or alternatively Jews, will not replace us." Upon reaching the Jefferson statue at the center of the school, they began beating, with torches and sticks, the several dozen anti-fascist protesters assembled there, while shouting "Die, Commie," and racial slurs. One of the Black Lives Matter activists had lighter fluid poured on them, but luckily wasn't burned. After beating the students, the neo-Nazis continued to march to a nearby church where an anti-fascist meeting had been organized by clergy. They had gathered there for an event to hear from the local leaders and others, including Cornel West. The church was being secured by a group of redneck revolt volunteers who were armed with shotguns, pistols, and long rifles, as well as a mass contingent of anti-fascists. As the neo-Nazis approached, the anti-fascists engaged them in a brawl, stopping them short of reaching the church, where they no doubt had planned to attack as they had done to the students. Redneck Revolt assisted in evacuating the attendees of the church as the brawl ensued. Cornel West went on to say that at multiple points throughout the weekend, it was these brave people who were willing to engage the fascists, confront them directly, that saved them. The fascists included the Klan, the National Socialist Movement, American Vanguard, Traditional Workers' Party, KECS, League of the South, Proud Boys, Identity Europa, and many others, showing a degree of unity amongst the anti-Semitic sections of the broader fascist milieu. The so-called Unite the Right rally included a plethora of infamous fascist leaders who did the work to organize it, including Jason Kessler, Richard Spencer, Baked Alaska, Based Stickman, Nathan D'Amigo, Matthew Heinbach, even David Duke, and Chris Cantwell, who we'll talk a little bit more about later. These white supremacists came far more materially prepared to fight than the anti-racist counter-protesters. And this was something that was noticed by everybody. Each fascist group had contingents of men armed with riot shields, helmets, body armor, bludgeons, pepper spray, flares, and even tear gas. In addition, the militia, who primarily functioned to defend the fascists, were openly carrying an assortment of firearms, including assault rifles. The fascists operated in a fashion that demonstrated they had been practicing maneuvers intended to be deployed in these street battles, with spotters calling out commands from behind fortified lines. This isn't surprising, as the development of their tactics can be seen from Sacramento and Berkeley up to now. By the time the fascists began arriving for their rally sometime around 10 a.m., there were already hundreds and soon to be thousands of counter-protesters surrounding Emancipation Park, where the rally was set to take place. The police only blocked off two sides of the park and claimed that the fascists had backed out of a plan to escort them into the park from that one particular direction. Instead, violently plowing through counter-protesters at different points to reach the park. One side of the park was left without any police presence at all. And for several hours, wave after wave of fascists would attempt to leave the park in this direction, fighting the anti-fascists in continuous melee, and constantly being beaten back into the park by the anti-fascists. Projectiles were thrown back and forth through that few hours, and by 11:30-ish in the morning, the assembly was declared unlawful, and a state of emergency declared, as anti-fascists had managed to begin pushing into the park. Folks were instructed that they would not be permitted in Emancipation Park or McIntyre Park, where fascists were attempting to regroup after taking beatings from the anti-fascists, or on the streets of downtown Charlottesville. You were to be arrested if you were really anywhere. The police cleared the park of fascists, pushing them back in the direction they had come from, toward the crowd of anti-fascist protesters, exacerbating the ongoing clashes. During this time, most of the so-called alt-right groups, including Spencer himself, went toe-to-toe with the police, fighting them and attempting to beat them back. But of course, not one of these people was arrested for assaulting a police officer. Whether rumor or fact, it's not totally clear, but the plan of the fascists seemed to have been spread through the counter-protesters, and they thought that they would regroup at McIntyre Park and then march on a predominantly black housing project in Charlottesville. Counter-protesters crowded into downtown streets to prepare to block the fascists from marching on the housing project and to celebrate their victory, as thousands of them had prevented the rally from going forward, and not a single fascist spoke that day. As you can see, there were hundreds, thousands of protesters who actually prevented them from getting a platform, the demonstration shut down. This is a big victory. And around this time, witnesses, including a photographer for the local paper, spotted a Dodge Challenger turning a corner to face the anti-racist protesters who were reveling in their victory. This photographer actually mentioned that he witnessed the Challenger backing up slowly. He thought that he was going to be leaving the area. But that's when this white supremacist terrorist who had marched with American Vanguard, an organization which quickly denied that he's a member, but we're fairly certain he is since he was wearing their uniform. Slowly reversed the car and then drove full speed into the crowd, wounding up to 19 people and killing Heather Heyer. The police deployed a heavily armored vehicle and forces to the scene of this terrorist attack rather than chasing him down, and began policing the folks there, including putting a stop to life-saving CPR that was being given to Heather Heyer by anti-fascist street medics. There is no guaranteeing that this treatment would have saved Heather's life, but the decision of the police to interfere with her medical treatment, if she stood any chance at that time, ensured she would die. The next day, notorious white supremacist Jason Kessler, who organized the Unite the Right rally, attempted to host a press conference where he attempted to place blame squarely on the shoulders of the left and to play as though the white man is the quintessential victim and on the brink of extinction, or some other nonsense. He also gave us some, you know, false words about, you know, denouncing the violence. But let's go ahead and show what happened to Jason Kessler.
And people resorting to violence. Yesterday.
Oh, Jason.
Indict murder now.
Indict
for murder now.
Indict
for murder. Invited.
I'll be in Washington.
There's another raw footage angle where you get to see the terror in his face a lot more as he's running away, which is greatly appreciated. But you can see that when the working class gets together, these fascists don't stand a chance, right?
Right. Yeah.
Thank you. When they get together and they commit themselves to bold action, right, he was not allowed to speak. Not because there's the government or anyone else telling him he can't speak, but because we say he can't speak, especially not after murdering somebody. So that was a powerful moment in the wake of this tragedy that I wanted to share. Now, in nearly every national tragedy, such as this one, the government makes some feigned semblance of condolence to those who are victimized by hate, racist police terror, or whatever it may be, and calls for unity and prayers abound. It's always just a gesture, of course. It's usually not intended with very much real sentiment. But Trump is different. Trump didn't go to Heather Heyer's memorial service, or even send a delegate from the administration, or even contact her mother to express any regret over the racism and open white supremacy he has stoked for 2 years that led to her murder. Trump is truly a sociopath and a monster, and will be remembered as one of the worst criminals to ever take up residence in that criminal building. In his first off-the-cuff statement, he claimed that there was violence and wrongdoing on many sides, putting an equal sign between the terrorism of the fascists on the one hand and the defensive acts and bravery of the anti-fascists on the other, who truly saved lives. There can be nothing more incredulous or stupid than trying to compare the planned and coordinated violence of forces who hope for the ethnic cleansing of the U.S. and the establishment of a white ethnostate by their very own declaration with those who are willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to stand in the way of that genocidal program of fascism.